eyes now fixed on his butt, which is showcased in perfect jeans. I mean, just yum. My phone buzzes in physics, and I sneak it out of my bag and glance at it under the desk. David, busy after school? I glance back at him. For a moment, I forgot how different he looks, and I'm startled all over again. My stomach clenches. Annie's not wrong. He's delicious. Me. Nope. What did you have in mind? David. First, we need to feed you. Me. Kay. David. Then we start the accident project, like we talked about. Right. The accident project. David's idea to help me figure things out. Is there such a thing as Masochists Anonymous? Because clearly I need to go there pronto. I look at Mr. Schmidt. I don't want to listen to him drone on about Newton's third law and stare in suspense as I wait for that little flake of tuna fish stuck to his mustache to fall. I'd much rather be out of class, eating with David, and even, yes, undertaking the accident project, as sick as that may be. Me. Let's go now. David. Now? But physics. My hand raises in the air, an impulsive move, and I talk without waiting for Mr. Schmidt to call on me. I'm going to the nurse, I say assertively, like I'm not asking for permission. I pack up my books and my computer and walk out the door, my brain still a few steps behind my legs. Better make good use of my one short life. I leave it up to David whether he wants to follow me.
Chapter 15. David. If I hadn't gotten Miney's makeover, I could have just walked right out, slipped through the door without a single person noticing. Now, because of new clothes and 3 fewer inches of hair, I need to come up with an excuse, a lie, because I have shed my cloak of invisibility. Of course I'm following her, that's not even up for debate. There's just no way I could stay here and finish out the remaining 42 minutes of this period, staring mournfully at her empty chair. Also, Gabriel is sitting next to me in all his olfactory glory, and I can't bring myself to ask about my missing notebook. It's gone. Stolen. I feel it nearby, though, like a phantom limb. I've decided not to worry. Surely they'll read the first page, realize it's not full of history or physics notes, and then give it right back. No harm, no foul. Mr. Schmidt, I need to... I make a mental note that next time I will think of my excuse before I raise my hand. He's looking at me. No, not just Mr. Schmidt. The entire class. Again. I need to empty my bowels. I say it loudly and with confidence, which Miney claims is the key to a good lie. Sounding like you believe it yourself. There is laughter, but it holds a different quality than usual. It doesn't sound like breaking glass. It sounds collaborative. Could the change be a result of my haircut and new clothes? Nah. I may not like my classmates, but they can't be so stupid that their opinion of me could be swayed by something as inconsequential as my appearance. TMI, Mr. Schmidt says, which I know from Urban Dictionary means too much information, an expression that makes little sense to me because my defining ethos is that there is never enough information. That's how one gets smarter. Go, Mr. Drucker. He points to the door, and though it doesn't fit my cover story, I'm a terrible liar, I throw my backpack over my shoulder and run. I find Kit in the school parking lot, standing in the middle of the road with her head back and her arms outstretched. It's snowing, she says. Can you believe it? I nod because I can believe it. Last night, when I checked my NOAA Radar Pro weather app, it said there was a 72% chance of precipitation today between the hours of 1 and 5 p.m. It's 26 degrees.
Sorry to make you skip. I just thought...
She doesn't finish her sentence, just lets the words trail off into the air, sublimated into another form, like snow to fog. I reach over and catch a flake just before it lands on her cheek. Did you know that it's not mathematically impossible for two snowflakes to be identical? They're made up of a quintillion molecules that can form in various geometries, so it's just highly improbable.
A quintillion?
Picture a one and then add 18 zeros. She shrugs, and I don't think she pictures it. Which is too bad because the image of a quintillion looks just like a line of poetry. The point is, it's totally possible. Unlikely, of course. The chances are like one in a gazillion, which is not an actual number, but an exaggerative placeholder. But you get my point. It's possible. I look at the falling snow, wonder if any of these flakes have a twin somewhere, if they have somehow defied the odds. Here's the thing about making a friend that I didn't understand before I started talking to Kit. They grow your world. Allow for previously inconceivable possibilities. Before Kit, I never used the word lonely, though that's exactly what I was. My mind felt too tight, too populated by a single voice. I don't like excessive noise or light or smell, which are the inevitable byproducts of human interaction, and yet my consciousness, that which will hopefully survive my inevitable death, still longs for personal connection, just like everyone else's. It's basic physics, really. We all need an equal and opposing force. Kit stares at me, and I stare back. Eye contact usually feels like an ice headache, just too much, too fast, sharp and unpleasant. With Kit, it feels like the first few seconds on a roller coaster. All gravitational force, no escape, pure thrill. I am nervous. I keep talking. There's something comforting about the thought, isn't there? That even something crazy like that, two identical snowflakes, can actually happen? I think about that sometimes when I'm upset. She flashes her perfect smile at me, which isn't perfect, not really. Her third tooth from the left is slightly chipped, but it's literally breathtaking. And so I stop talking because I don't want to activate my asthma.
Everything is so unbelievably shitty right now, she says, even though she's still smiling. I can't even begin to tell you how shitty.
I nod. I don't know what to say to this. I want her words to match her face, or maybe to a lesser degree, vice versa. A tear escapes out of the corner of her eye, and she wipes it away, fast.
But I'm going to take that as good news. The snowflake thingy, Kit says. So thank you for that.
Should we walk? I ask, because I suddenly don't want to climb into a car. I want to stay outside in this light, quiet snow. I want to stand next to Kit. Watch her brace herself against the wind. Hear the tiny whoosh of snow as it falls onto her jacket.
Yes, please, she says.
And then, like it's the most natural thing in the world, like we do it all the time, she interlaces her fingers with mine. We hold hands for 2 minutes and 29 seconds, but when we turn the corner onto Clancy Boulevard, we stop, and I wish I knew who initiated the release. Did I get distracted by the counting and accidentally reduce my pressure, thus signaling a desire to let go? I don't know. There's a 92% chance it was Kit.
I liked the feeling of her hand in mine. Her fingers were longer than I would have guessed, the collective weight of a dog's paw. I think about what it would be like to kiss her, to touch my fingertip to her clavicle cluster, to not worry about our physical boundaries. I imagine it would be like splitting an atom, a distillation into component parts. Everything small enough to be countable. Everything as perfect and forever as pie. You're quiet today, Kit says. We haven't spoken in 2 minutes and 29 seconds. Too hard to talk and hold hands at the same time. That would be system overload. Was just thinking, I say.
Me too. I wish I could do it less.
What?
Thinking.
I look over and see that Kit's face is wet. From the snow? From tears? Has she been crying since we left school? You're sad, I say, and it occurs to me that it is entirely possible, likely even, that I've been having the best 2 minutes and 29 seconds of my life while Kit has been crying. No, I was wrong. There will never be two identical snowflakes, and I will forever be out of sync with the rest of the world. I look at the mini-mall across the street because I don't want to see Kit's face. The mini-mall is an emotion-free zone. A bagel place, a dry cleaner, the liquor mart, and a knick-knack store that sells an assortment of useless items like miniature figurines and napkin holders. Why do they wrap everything up in clear cellophane and twirled ribbon? Little Moments. That's what that store is called. Little Moments. I hate that place almost as much as I hate Justin.
My mom cheated on my dad. I just found out, Kit says, and uses both of her hands to wipe her face. How screwed up is that?
I don't say anything, because I'm pretty sure her question is rhetorical, and if it's not, I wouldn't even know how to begin to measure the precise dimensions of how screwed up something is. So I stay quiet and wait for her to say more. This technique seems to work with Kit.
I don't even know what to do, you know? Like, what the hell am I supposed to do with that information? She asks.
And this time I think she is seriously asking, but before I can answer, she goes on.
It's all irrelevant now anyway. I mean, he's dead. D-E-A-D, dead. Adios, amigo. Hasta la vista, baby. Why should it matter?
I'm sorry. I picture a Venn diagram and three circles overlapping for this catch-all phrase. I'm sorry. Best used, one, when someone is sad, two, when someone dies, and three, when you have no idea what else to say. In this case, all three apply. In my mind, I scribble the word Kit in the overlap. It probably doesn't matter, but I get upset all the time about things that don't matter. Like open loops, for instance. We cross at the light, and I let Kit lead the way. I have $33.15 on me. More than enough cash to pay for a meal for both of us and most of Mapleview's under $2 sign Yelp-rated restaurants. I doubt Kit would pick $3 signs.
I don't know why I'm telling you all this, she adds. I haven't even told Vi or Annie.
We're friends. I say it like it's no big deal, like it's the truth and has always been the truth. And also, like I'm not suddenly terrified that just by uttering the words out loud, I've put myself in the I will never get the opportunity to kiss Kit Lowell zone. Anyhow, I wish there were a way to fix this for you. I would undo it if I could.
You're sweet, she says,
and that smile is back. The one that I'm starting to realize is not a smile at all. It just resembles one in form, The snow is starting to fall harder now in bigger geometrical formations, rendering the possibility of two matching ones infinitely more remote. You know what we need? To rip a major hole in the space-time continuum. And then we could go back in time and fix everything for you. I realized with a pang that time travel would do nothing to fix me. I'm different at the genetic molecular level. We'd have to alter my dad's sperm or my mother's egg, which would, in effect, undo my very existence. I don't want that. Have you asked your mom why? Why she cheated on my dad? Yeah. No. Maybe you should. Could help close the loop. You are obsessed with this loop concept. Think about the infinity sign, I say, and I wait for her to do it, to imagine it. She stops walking, and so I assume that's what's happening. She's letting me paint pictures in her mind. Picture me kissing you, I want to say. Picture that. You see how it just flows into itself. Or even the concept of pi. It has an order and a rhythm and doesn't end. Ever. Continuous flow. That's how everything should be. Closed loops. Just ask your mom why. I like your new haircut, she answers, apropos of nothing, and then reaches up to touch my head, I think. But then she jams her hands back into her jacket pockets. Your outsides match your insides better now. I don't know what that means, I reply. She doesn't answer me, though. Kit just stares up at the sky and lets the snow bathe her face with its infinite variation.
Chapter 16. Kit. I pull out my phone, text my mother. One word and a question mark. Why? She writes back immediately. Mom, let's do this in person. Me. No, just tell me. Simple question. Mom. It's complicated. Me. Try me. Mom. You won't understand. Me. Never mind. Mom. I was lonely. And stupid. But mostly lonely. I texted and asked, and my mom says she was lonely, I say to David, ignoring the absurdity of the whole situation. Me sharing the intimate details of my family life with him, of all people. That we are sitting here in McCormick's eating hamburgers in a purple vinyl booth, like an almost date. That he looks like an ad from a magazine for boxer briefs, and I'm dressed again in my dad's shirt, making the same mistake twice. That I've listened to David in the first place, and broken my silence with my mother and texted at his casual suggestion. That we keep talking about this concept of open loops, like everything can be fixed if we just put our collective brain power into it. He smiles, like this is good news. That makes sense, he says. No, it doesn't, I say. Nothing makes sense. It's sad to think about, though, he says, as though he didn't hear me. Being married and still being lonely. She's just making excuses for herself. Have you ever heard of twin prime numbers? David asks. I see him revving up to a new topic, and I can't decide if I want to go down this road with him. My mind feels mushy and overused. Maybe this wasn't a good idea, skipping class, taking this long walk in the snow. I liked holding David's hand, though. That part. The snow dampening my face, letting my tears mix without anyone seeing. His fingers snug in mine. That was nice. His hand was heavier than I would have guessed. More solid. Like he could keep me from flying away. Nope, I say. I take a bite of hamburger, think about Annie's obsession with the concept of mindfulness. She's always telling me it's important to be in the here and now, to taste your food, to feel your breathing, to notice when you go from sitting to standing. Since her parents' divorce, her mother has gone total hippie. She takes Annie on meditation and yoga retreats, and burns incense in the house to get rid of bad energy, and whenever I go over there, she tells me all about her adrenal fatigue, as if those are words I understand put together. Of course, that stuff has trickled down to Annie and then out to me and Violet. And so I decide to be here, in the now, whatever that means. I taste my burger. I really taste it. It's over-ketchuped and too pickly. The here and now is overrated. I let David fill our table up with conversation, his words like cartoon bubbles taking up the space I can't seem to fill. Which is a long way of saying, if he wants to talk prime numbers, so be it. Twin primes are prime numbers that differ from each other by 2, like 3 and 5, or 41 and 43. But what's cool about them is that they still exist even as you go higher and higher. Even though, as everyone knows, the gap between primes grows the higher the numbers. Of course, everyone knows that, I say. Right. So it's this strange, wonderful phenomenon. What does that mean? I was lonely and stupid. My mother is the smartest person I know. And I say that while I'm sitting across the table from David Drucker, who scored the highest on his PSATs of anyone in the tri-state area. Though my mother rarely lets her nerd flag fly, when she does, her brain is a phenomenal thing. I wonder if that's why Jack liked her. Wait, was it like, or was it love? Did Jack love her? Does he love her? Are they going to get married? And Evan and Alex will become my stepbrothers? And we'll go on family vacations all together again? And we'll pretend that it's not weird we've found ourselves in this new, previously unfathomable combination? Will we pretend that my dad never existed in the first place? I'm not sure what prime numbers have to do with anything, I say in a gentle voice. Prime numbers have to do with everything. But to clarify, that's what I imagine falling in love is like, and then staying married. You start out as low twin primes, and as time goes on, if you manage to defy the statistical odds and not get divorced, you become like those rarer twin primes, still only separated by 2. That's an amazing feat. How romantic, I say sarcastically, because to me the idea of falling in love, admittedly something I've never had the pleasure of experiencing, has nothing to do with prime numbers or mathematics or even quantum mechanics. It's more like music or art or poetry, something awe-inspiring and beautiful, maybe even surprising, like how I used to see my parents' relationship. It actually is super romantic. David looks down and fiddles with his straw. I think he's blushing, which makes me blush, even though I have no idea what he's talking about. Of course, when a good-looking guy uses the word romantic in all seriousness and blushes, whatever the context, even if you are talking about prime numbers, you're going to blush too. It's reflexive. It doesn't mean anything. I just thought, like, maybe your parents were, prime numbers that were drifting apart, and that's why your mom felt lonely, because her twin was too far away. Maybe, I say, not able to share his sympathetic views. I don't think my mother was lonely. She was just selfish, or even worse, horny. Ew. I am seriously feeling ill. Is that why you were crying? Because of your mom and dad? David asks. I haven't quite gotten used to this about him. as if the only way to go is straight through. And of course, there's the flip side to David's directness. I don't really want to talk about my crying. It's just a lot of things.
You look beautiful even when you cry. I mean, not that you don't look beautiful when you're happy. Of course, you're beautiful all the time. But out there in the snow, you were stunning.
My stomach tightens and I let out a little laugh. No, more like a gasp. What are you supposed to say when a guy says you're beautiful? This has never once come up. My body warms and buzzes with his words. My mind is racing. McCormick's is a good place. They sell milkshakes and have a little sign discouraging you from talking on your cell phone. I like sitting here with David, basking in his undeserved compliments.
Thanks, I say finally, after what feels like a long time in which I've been trying to think of what to say next.
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
He jumps up, reaches out from my hand, and I let him take it.
Now let's go check out the place your dad died and close that loop.
Over the course of the 3-block walk, I think of and abandon at least 5 different excuses to turn around. I never really meant it seriously, I tell myself. I never had any intention of embarking on what David has named the accident project. For David, obviously, this is nothing more than some sort of equation or a puzzle to be solved. Another one of his open loops to close. He can't tell that I'm sweating, even though it's freezing out, or that I feel dizzy with fear. And then I see the intersection of Plum and First. This corner is on the way to the grocery store, to the ballet classes I took until 3rd grade, to Violet's house, to Star of Punjab, to a million other landmarks of my childhood. The playground where Kenny Kibblewitz kissed me on the lips as part of a dare when we were 10. The park where, on many Sunday mornings when I was little, my dad and I would set up a picnic blanket and have a tea party with my teddy bears while my mom slept in and caught up on her beauty rest. Here it is, this intersection, looking as innocuous as always. No shattered glass, no flowers to mark the spot. My phone dings, a text message, and I assume it's from my mother. I don't want to think about her because thinking about her leads me to this inescapable fact. My dad did not die peaceful or happy with his place in the world. My dad died betrayed, minutes away from a freaking divorce filing. Right over there. Right over there. Right over there. X marks the spot with a circle and a dot. I pull my phone out of my pocket with the hand not holding David's. A text will buy me some time. Thinking about my mom having sex with Jack is preferable to thinking about the fact that my dad was mutilated by a navy blue Ford Explorer. Pain, it turns out, has a hierarchy. Not my mother, after all. It's a text from Violet instead. In all caps, 3 exclamation points. Weird. Annie's the text screamer among us, the one who deploys excessive punctuation for no reason.
I'm hungry!
Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, she'll write. Or, my shoes are killing me! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Ah!
Exclamation point. Violet prefers all lowercase, her texts as dainty as her clothes. Violet. OMG, Kit! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Have you seen this? Question mark, exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point. There's a link to someone's Tumblr. The Retard's Guide to Mapleview. Whatever.
I don't need to read another one of my classmates' dumb, offensive blogs. Last year, someone anonymously posted a How to Get the Ladies to Sex You guide, which was as disgusting as it sounds. I decide not to click. Whatever. The snow makes this more complicated, David says, and drops my hand to reach into his backpack. He pulls out measuring tape. There's something about the gesture, the fact that he brought measuring tape to school, that brings more tears to my eyes. I wonder what else is hiding in his bag. I picture a compass and maybe a scientific calculator. I imagine he's fully prepared for the zombie apocalypse, just like my dad. I don't think it's falling that fast, so we can just measure its density once and take that into account. I have no idea what it is we're actually doing. What are we measuring? I think about the word density and suddenly don't remember what it means. The report said your dad died at 6:52 p.m. Do you know if he died on impact? Because if he did, that can be the time we work back from. David's voice is flat, dimensionless. I'm not sure this is a good idea. I say it out loud, that which has been repeating in my head. Not a good idea. Not a good idea, not a good idea, and also this. Run, run, run. Let's not do this. David turns and looks me up and down. I'm trembling from head to toe. This is hard for you, he says matter-of-factly, as if it is just occurring to him. Yes, I say. It's just a place. If you want, I can pull up our coordinates. That way, it's not even a place, he says. And then he does it. He gives me our location based on latitudinal and longitudinal measurements. If my ears weren't whooshing, if my stomach wasn't pulled tight into my throat, I'd laugh. If you don't want to do this, we don't have to. But I don't like that you aren't sleeping. We need sleep for our bodies to function efficiently. He died afterward, not in the car, at the hospital. I answer and match his tone. Clinical detachment. Maybe I can do this and not shatter like the Volvo's windshield. And if I don't break, I like to think I have a chance of getting better, or at least closing my eyes at night and not opening them again until morning. Maybe there is a good reason we are doing this. Answers. I could use some answers. Let's not work by time, then. Let's figure out where the car had to have stopped before there would have been a collision. Would that be okay with you? I don't answer. We are now at the corner, staring at the middle of the intersection. There are no cars around. If I wanted to, I could walk right into the center of the road. There's nothing here, just some trash dancing in the wind.
We're missing a bunch of variables, but I think we can make reasonable estimations.
I am going to throw up, because it's replaying right in front of me, as if I were watching it live, the screeching of tires, an explosion of blue, everything turning black, the smell. Oh, God, the smell. I'm sorry. I can't, I say, and turn around and put my hand over my mouth. I bite back the bile. No, I do not want to throw up in front of David. I will not display my digested burger on the pristine snow. Still, the trembling is getting worse, and the nausea curdles into vertigo. The world starts to spin, and the ground begins to undulate, like I've stepped into a three-dimensional funhouse mirror. I need to get out of here. Now.
If you want, I can do the math without you, he says,
but to my back, because I'm already running, slipping on the wet ground, hurling myself as fast as I can to get away.
Chapter 17. David. after Kit ran away from me, I spent another 55 minutes outside in the snow by myself, measuring velocity and rate of acceleration and doing calculations in my head and on my phone, since I didn't have my notebook to write them down. Now that I'm home, I need to readjust after all that time alone, after all those words and numbers tumbled and boomeranged in my brain, after watching Kit's departing back and wondering why she left me there without so much as a goodbye. I know that if I were someone else, I'd get that elusive subtext that everyone else seems to come pre-programmed with and understand why she suddenly, without warning, found me so disgusting. That's the only word I can use to describe the look on her face. Disgust. Did she know I wanted to kiss her? I'm not ready for Miney, who greets me at the door as if she is going to hug me. The purple stripe in her hair is blaring, like a trumpet. No, like car brakes screeching to a halt. It's everywhere, Miney says, and I notice she's still in her odd duck pajamas. Again, she hasn't left the house. Her eyes are red-rimmed but not crusty. Not pink eye, then. If she had an infection, there would be secretions. What's everywhere? I ask, but I don't really care. All I am thinking about is Kit's hand in mine, how she makes me brave. How did she know I wanted to kiss her? I already know I'm a terrible liar, but it's not like she asked me outright, "Do you want to kiss me?" Your notebook. I have no idea what Miney's talking about. What does that mean, my notebook is everywhere? A notebook is a fixed object. The laws of physics don't allow it to be in more than one place at a time, unless we are talking about the multiverse. But Miney doesn't understand the concept. I've tried explaining it lots of times. Someone put it on the internet, Miney says, and hands me her phone. Tumblr. The title, The Retard's Guide to Mapleview. My body shakes, just once, as if absorbing a single blow. Oh, I say.
Oh, that's it?
I thought they stole it from my physics notes, that they would give it right back when they realized it wasn't going to be helpful. Why would they do this? I'm not sure why I even bother to ask, because I should know by now I will never understand the answer, why anyone ever does anything. My notebook was supposed to be private.
Who did this? She asks.
I don't answer. It doesn't matter. My notebook is no longer a tangible thing. It's like a dead person's consciousness. There, but not there. Everywhere at once.
Little D, who?
Miney grabs me by the shoulders, forces me to look her in the eye. Justin Cho and Gabriel Forsyth.
I'll kill them,
Miney says, which is a nice offer, but I don't want her to go to jail. Then I wouldn't be able to talk to her whenever I wanted. We'd have to sit across from each other in a dirty vestibule, converse through bulletproof glass. Miney is a picky eater. She'd hate prison food. Maybe people will stop reading as soon as they realize that it's private, I say, hopeful. Still stupidly hopeful. I never learn.
Not likely. Six of my friends sent it to me in the past few minutes.
I picture the word viral, a soiled word, and imagine my book as a pathogen, multiplying exponentially, replicating itself like a cancer cell. I nod. I get it now. As usual, it just takes me a few extra beats. My body reacts first. My hands flap side to side, and my legs shake up and down. I look like a bird readying for flight. I haven't flapped like this since the sixth grade, when Miney filmed me on her phone and explained that if I ever wanted to have any friends, I needed to stop. And to my amazement, next time I caught myself doing it, I was able to quit. I replaced the motion with silent counting, though by then the damage had already been done. Apparently, no one wants to be friends with the kid who used to flap.
How bad is it, Miney? Tell me, how bad?
I am hoping there's something I'm missing here. Maybe it's not so strange. Maybe other people do this same thing. Keep a notebook about their classmates. Or maybe it will be helpful after all, just like my physics notes would have been. Nope. Justin and Gabriel titled the page The Retard's Guide to Mapleview. Don't they realize you aren't supposed to use that word? That it's offensive even to those who actually have Down syndrome? Unless they meant the adjective form of the word, i.e. retarded, as in slow or limited, rather than the noun they've used. Not sure if that's a fair or politically correct usage, but this sort of thing, this abject humiliation, doesn't seem to happen to the neurotypical. I picture Kit running away from me, not even slowing down as she slipped on the snow. I picture Kit reading my notebook, relieved she got away from me just in time.
This is bad, like very, very, very bad, Miney says. I'm sorry.
I'm going to go see the principal. She'll make those animals take it down, my mother says as she comes running into our living room from the kitchen, her car keys already in her hand. She's heading toward the front door.
We could take legal action. That violates your constitutional right to privacy.
You saw it too? I ask. My eyes are closed now. The darkness helps. Too many sounds. Too many thoughts. Too much of everything. I need darkness and quiet.
We'll fix this, my mom says.
Her voice breaks, like a 13-year-old boy's. I'm glad I can't see her face. I don't want to know what I'd see there. I consider sticking my fingers in my ears, but that would be going too far, even for me.
I promise.
Mom, you can't go to school, Miney says. You'll just make it worse.
They can't get away with this. They just can't.
Miney and my mother go on like this for a few minutes, arguing about what they should do next. Just from their tone, I can tell this is so much worse than the locker room incident, when Justin stuffed me in a locker in 7th grade right after convincing me to join him in a bathroom stall because he said he had something cool to show me. That was a lie. Instead, he grabbed my neck and gave me a swirly in a dirty toilet, and that was bad. I know because my mom cried when she came to pick me up from school that time and spent the whole next day in bed. I know because my dad's self-defense training started soon thereafter. I know because the next week my sister bought me a notebook and started making me write down rules and telling me who I could and could not trust. I know because I couldn't shake the smell for weeks. I know because some of the kids still call me shithead. I know because later, when I really allowed myself to think about it and what I had allowed to happen to me, that day cracked me wide open. I stop listening. No, this isn't fixable. I see that now. Reading my notebook is like opening up my brain and exposing to the uncaring world all the parts that don't make sense. The parts that make me a freak or a moron or a loser or whatever words people like to throw at me. The parts to them that make me other. The parts to me that make me me. Miney is right. This is very, very, very bad. Your outsides match your insides better now, Kit said earlier. But she was wrong. No, Now my real insides are all on the outside for everyone to pick apart and laugh at. I'm like roadkill. I'll be looked at, examined, but I won't even be eaten. I'm not worth that much. Kit was right about one thing. I am disgusting. I don't say anything to Miney or my mother. I don't really care what they decide to do. Doesn't matter at all. Notebook or not, I'll still be me. Someone who disgusts. So instead, I go up to my bedroom and close the door.
Chapter 18. Kit. The Retard's Guide to Mapleview, which is horribly offensive, reads like a compilation of strange online dating profiles. I've made it back to school and to my car, and even through the terrible drive home without throwing up. I open the link because I need distraction. I'm tired of the constant hole in my stomach, that slow burn of loss. I will never see my father again. Nothing I will ever do can change that. I wonder if one day soon I will forget the sound of his voice. I can't imagine a world where I can't conjure up its deep bass, where I can't conjure up the planes of his face, or the feeling of his hand on my forehead. That's not a world I want to live in. At first glance, the guide just looks like a bunch of scanned pages from a handwritten notebook. Alphabetical entries about different people in our class. A list of rules, the first three of which say, "Do not engage with anyone on the DNT list." What does DNT mean? Annie, who speaks acronym, would probably know. There's a long list of people's names with random descriptions and observations that are equal parts poetic and bizarre. Violet is described as cinched because of her predilection for pointed collars and belts. Jessica's blonde hair is called offensively fluorescent. Abby's perfume, the olfactory equivalent of dying of asphyxiation by an old lady's farts, which is, come to think of it, remarkably accurate. A list of notable encounters for almost every person in our class, and elaborate charts about different friend groups. What the hell is this? My phone dings. Violet. Kit, did you get the link I sent? ! Annie. Read it now! ! Holy crap! ! Something about their texts makes me look away from the screen for a second. I try to think of other things. David's hand in mine. That was nice. Innocent, friendly hand-holding. I think of his tape measure and his haircut. I think about what it might be like to kiss him. Not that I really think of him that way, like a boyfriend or even just a hookup. But still, I imagine kissing him would feel good. A true thing. A real thing. I imagine he tastes like honesty. And then I see it. While I'm absent-mindedly flipping through the pages on my phone. A lovely sketch of the back of a girl's neck. A drawing of a circle of freckles on a clavicle. They look oddly familiar. That's my neck. That's my clavicle. And then it hits me. This is David's notebook. Oh, shit.
Chapter 19. David.
3.14149265381711706789386211706982097498321679386511
Stop. No. It's too much. The noise and the light and the vibrations and the thoughts in my head looping tighter and tighter, like their fingers choking my neck, and the sun stabbing my eyes, and an unknown hand squeezing my balls all at once. I burrow under my heavy blankets. One last time. I need to escape this feeling. One last time. 3.14149265381711706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706789386211706
Kit. Listen, I'm not saying you're ugly or anything. You're totally cute enough, but you're so not the prettiest girl in school. Willow says, by way of greeting, when I march into the pizza palace, and as expected, they're all gathered around a laptop reading from David's notebook. No one seems to care that this is his private journal or diary or whatever. Justin and Gabriel and Jessica Willow Abbey are here. Annie and Violet, too, though they are sitting in a separate booth. Shut your pie hole. Kit's beautiful, Annie says, and I want to high-five her for defending me, for still being on my team, despite the fact that I suck lately. Not that I disagree with Willow. Despite David's delusions, I am in no way one of the more attractive girls at school. I don't know who David sees when he looks at me, if he has funhouse mirror eyes, but it's certainly not the same me everyone else sees. He's right about the other stuff, though, and it's sweet of him to have noticed. I do sit cross-legged on most chairs, and I have a nervous habit of covering my fingers with my sweatshirt sleeves, which annoys my mom because I always stretch them out. Is writing down my license plate number? All right, fine. That's borderline creepy. I think you're the one who needs to do that, Willow says to Annie. Did you read what David Drucker said about your jeans being too tight? Obvi, you're going to stop being friends with him, right? Jessica asks, and I try to remember what notes David made about her, but the only thing I can come up with is her hair. It is too bright. Hair color should not be viewable from space. I'm still not sure why he described each member of our class, but the entries read like the shorthand I sometimes use when I'm programming the number of someone whose name I'm not likely to remember into my phone. Eyebrow-piercing boy from Model UN, redheaded girl from PSAT class. Maybe David has a problem with names. Why would I do that? I ask, but then realize I'm getting distracted. I'm not here to deal with these girls. I don't want to dip my toes into their smallness. Why do they care what David has to say about them anyway? They've all said so much worse about him over the years. No, I'm here to see Gabriel and Justin, who have both opened their arms out wide to me for a hug. The cheap feels, Violet calls it, when the boys try to touch us for no good reason. Arms over shoulders, a squeeze of our sides, even sometimes a yank of a ponytail like we are kindergartners. It's not sexual. It's more like how people grab a handful of free mints from a bowl as they're leaving a restaurant. Greedy. David doesn't do any of that. Just holds my hand like it's something delicate. Did you do it? I ask Justin, trying to look tough. Which is silly since I have never looked tough. I'm just too goddamn normal to look tough. David's list of notable encounters with Justin was 5 pages long, going all the way back to elementary school. Justin's plans to humiliate David were ambitious, I'll give him that, and perfectly tailored to his adversary's weaknesses. Why would someone want to so utterly destroy someone else? Is Justin a sociopath? And how come we were all so willing to stand next to him and laugh? I had forgotten about the time in middle school he tortured David in the bathroom. What did I say when I heard? Did I laugh too? I hope not, but I can't be sure. It was a long time ago. I know I didn't call him shithead like lots of people did afterward. Not just then, too, but for years. At least I didn't do that. Still, small solace. The truth is, David wasn't a real person to me until he was.
What are you talking about?
Justin pats the seat next to him with 2 fingers, like I'm a puppy who takes directions via pointing. Like Jessica's hair, how have I never before noticed his cruel streak? How did I ever find him amusing? I've been overly impressed by the fact that he's smart and athletic and occasionally witty. Stupid distractions that somehow kept me from realizing he's actually a big asshole. The guide to Mapleview? You guys posted it, right? I hate that I pose it as a question. Give them room to say, no, sorry, didn't do it.
Nope,
Justin says right on cue, though the corners of his mouth lift and betray him. He's proud of himself.
Wasn't us. Dude, your boyfriend's weird,
Gabriel says, and my first instinct is to say, he's not my boyfriend. But I don't. Not because David is my boyfriend, but because it feels disloyal. Like I'm embarrassed to be associated with him now. I really don't care what they think. I'm disgusted by these people, which is perhaps the only upside I can think of to what has happened to me in the past month. My life will be better without Justin and Gabriel and afternoons like this one. Sure, David is even more awkward than I realized. Okay, not just awkward, but deeply different. So unaware of social norms that he has to keep a notebook to learn them, like an exchange student from Mars. Who cares? If someone published the pages of my journal, which I will burn the second I get home, come to think of it, there'd be some weirdo stuff in there, too. I think about my dad's favorite expression, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. What is my house made of? Paper, I decide. Like in a pop-up book. Easily collapsible. You guys really are such douches, I say. I bet you're enjoying this.
It's kind of funny, Gabriel says.
Whatever. It's like so rude that he said all that stuff about us, Willow says, pouting, though she doesn't actually look upset, more like she's posing for a selfie. Do any of them have real human emotions? Why do I suddenly feel like I'm surrounded by actors cast as teenagers? Like I'm the only one with a real and messy life. I realize that can't be true. I've heard that Abby goes to an outpatient eating disorder clinic, and that Jessica has experimented with cutting, which suggests that despite their shiny exteriors, they're also fighting their own demons.